So with this 7:30 period now, we kind of formally begin the process of preparing to go back to life as it is sometimes known. And we try to do it with some care, that this transition is an important time. There's a long tradition in Buddhism that a lot of the wisdom that comes from practice doesn't come from going down deep, but comes from going as far deep as you go, if that's the metaphor you like, deep. But rather, wisdom comes when you come out, when you surface again. And there's something about perspective or the contrast or the vantage point of, for example, being calm, you can see something about how agitation happens as you get agitated again. Something about the vantage point of seeing that you've dropped a lot of your concerns, and you can watch them beginning to come back in. And because in daily life they're all kind of swirling and fast and just a big kind of combination of everything. And it's hard to see the origin, the beginning, and the triggers, and you know how it all, what's going on with them. Here sometimes there's a lot of self that gets let go of, a lot of self-concern, self-preoccupation, self-definition, and then it'll come back soon enough. But here in the transition you can watch it begin. Maybe by the fifth day here you weren't so concerned about what people thought about you as you walked around in your socks and whatever. Once we start, you know, break silence tomorrow, the social concerns come back. And maybe they'll come back slow enough you can see them in a new way, and understand what's going on in a deeper way, in a helpful way. So this period here is the beginning of that transition, and we kind of go through the next hours alternating between activity and more engaged, and right now some talking, and then quiet and silence. Tomorrow morning there'll be a period of silence, period of more work activity than we have been. So we clean the center and clean your rooms, and going back into silence, back and forth. And it's meant to be as important part of the retreat as any of the rest of the retreat. And so the opportunity for you, if you take it, is to continue to be mindful, respect the times of silence, be mindful of times when you're working, or you know, see what goes on with you. And naturally, most people find that their mind gets more energy and more thinking comes back and less settled. And some people, feel some discouragement because all the hard work, now it's coming back. Some people will, as soon as their mind starts getting a little bit busier, will come to the conclusion that the retreat's basically over. That was, you know, I'm not going to go deep anymore. And so then you just blow off the rest of the, you know, hours here, just like it doesn't count. There's all kinds of attitudes that come along, but it's really a practice, just like, following your breath. I don't know how many, I never calculate how many breaths I followed over my career, but 40 years of following my breath, you know, pretty much every day for, could probably calculate, and a lot of breaths, and I still find it interesting and valuable to do it. It's not like, oh, if I figured that one out and just another breath, I might as well just skip it. So the same thing with this transition. Some of you have gone through it before. Oh, you know, here we go again, you know, like, oh, you know, I guess I have to do it. Gail's not going to like it if I leave early or something. But in fact, this is actually an important part of the retreat. If you take it that way and bring mindfulness to it, then you get as much out of it as you put into it. So this begins here now. And I thought that since it's been such a big part of the day, I thought I would say a little bit more, add to what Paul said about our friends across the street. You know, it's hard to know where that kind of grunting and male chanting and what in the world's going on over there? And now, some of you probably have all kinds of fantasies, and I do, and stories about what's going on, and they're probably coming over to raid us any moment now. At least the refrigerator. And so they're, to get a little flavor of them, they're, they have a supreme leader. That's called the Supreme Grand Humbug. That's his title. And it's a kind of national organization that's a kind of about 160 years old. And it was partly created as a parody of the Freemasons and other organizations like that. And so they have initiation rites, but they're kind of like a parody, apparently. And they're kind of like whimsical, and seems like they're out to have a good time in their way. And so they're probably good people in their way. Who knows what they are, but that puts it a little different spin on whatever your fantasies have been. What's going on. And Paul and I put it in a different context this evening, because, okay, you think I'll tell them what happened? You think I should say it, or you should not say anything?
What happened?
what we saw later in the this evening when we went for a walk? So they had a certain impression over there, and so Paul and I went, we've been walking after Dharma talk down at the local park, and they have a frisbee golf course. So we end up on the course. I wanted to show Paul the frisbee golf course, because just kind of, he'd never seen one. And he doesn't get to do things like that during sesshins. And there's people playing, this golf frisbee, throwing frisbee, and they're just playing frisbee, right? And two guys got into a real fist fight, throwing themselves on the ground. It looked pretty violent. It didn't last very long, but it was ugly. And so I thought, these guys are pretty good. I thought this grunting, and it's very different what goes on out in the world. So we tried to get up and try to help. By the time we got there, the fight was over. It was pretty quick, but it was pretty dramatic to see. So this is the world we live in. We live in a world with all kinds of things. And here for this retreat, we've offered you the teachings on the paramitas. And a very important context for this teaching is that of the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva vows. And I was very happy that we did this teaching together, because one of the shared aspects of Paul and I's kind of religious orientation is the bodhisattva vow, the bodhisattva ideal, and which is an ideal that expresses compassion and care and the desire to live a life for the welfare of all beings. And one of the things that I learned in the course of my practice, especially practicing at Zen Center, is, but in all my practice, is that a lot of the ideals are not so much out there that something to attain someday at somehow, but rather they live in us. And as we settle and open, and we find them in ourselves, and the teachings then describe them rather than instruct on them. And so, like the paramitas, they're instructions maybe, but they're also descriptions of what's here, what can be here. And when, at some point in practice, the hope is that these teachings are not foreign to you, but are speaking to what you know already in yourself. You find it here. So the same thing with the bodhisattva kind of the what it represents for me, at least, is that at some point as I practiced, compassion and concern for the suffering of the world became not just something that I have, but I think it just became who I am more. I think it was that kind of intimate or that kind of full or something. And so it just seemed like a Zen center taking what's called the Bodhisattva vows, this commitment to being a Bodhisattva, it wasn't so much, you know, taking something on as it was recognizing what's already here. And so going through, like we went, both of us went through this priest ordination at Zen Center, and for me it was, again, not so much taking something on as it was recognizing what was already present. And a key part of that was this idea of care and compassion for the world. And so these six paramitas are, you know, the intimate trainings, the intimate expression of a compassionate concern, living in the world in a compassionate way. Because if you live in a world compassionately, and caring for the suffering in the world, I think that a powerful expression of that is generosity. A powerful expression of it is ethical integrity, not causing harm, living in a way that doesn't cause harm. And I think that the compassion is motivating. It causes, you know, we want to engage, and we don't sit. I don't think there are couch potato bodhisattvas. You know, it's a motivating force. So there's you know, energy and effort, and then there's patience, acceptance. There's kind of a broad capacity of heart and mind to be open and available, and not reactive, and not automatically angry or for or against or apologetic or defensive or offensive, but the ability to really be present in a very full and open way and for this life, for what's here. And when Paul and I walked towards the fight this evening, I don't think either one of us had a clue what we were going to do. How do we do? What do we do? These guys were bigger than us, stronger than us, and all stronger than me. But what do we do? But this ability to, you know, somehow be this kind of powerful thing of kshanti. This is a truth, and step towards it, and open towards it, and see what happens. See what needs to be done. Or people who struggle, people who are in deep pain, all kinds of ways to have the kshanti, the ability to step forward and meet them without our reactivity taking over and getting caught with judgments and criticism. So I think it's an expression of his compassion. And the way I talked about dhyana or samadhi, that I think that the expression of compassion in all direction includes direct towards oneself, in the kind of way where there's such a deep willingness to hold ourselves in care and compassion that we can kind of really settle on ourselves or be ourselves or, you know, really be settled here, really kind of be at home in this moment. And then wisdom. I think the companion of compassion is wisdom. I'd like to believe that one of the expressions of compassion is the desire to be wise, to be considerate, to have insight, to look carefully, to have compassion without seeing carefully, without looking carefully at what's going on. It can be quite foolish. There's foolish compassion and blind compassion. But to see these as arising out of compassion, rising out of our hearts, and that as we settle, as we drop down and settle and drop the crusts, the fears, the hatreds, the hurts, the You know, it's so much that kind of, you know, makes it difficult for us to really touch into our hearts and minds. That as this falls away, our sensitivity to this world, our sensitivity that translates into empathy and compassion, becomes stronger. So I hope that that this teachings and the six paramitas in the context of compassion is supportive for you, and it would be nice if it was you found it all in yourself. You found something, it resonates with something in you. Because I know that the world needs more people who are willing to respond, willing to meet the suffering of the world and make a difference, and make this a safer, more welcoming place for all of us. So, at this retreat, we haven't done any questions in the hall here. So we can now take a little bit of time for your pent-up questions, if there are such things, or any questions you might have that you can address to Paul and I, maybe Paul first, and maybe do back and forth. And it can be anything about the teachings this week, or your experience here, or anything that you think is relevant to what we're doing here. And it's a generous thing to ask a question, because it's part of this transitioning time and allowing the transition to hear voices and speak and have this little different energy. So it's a part of our process here. Yes, Max, or Kim. Thank you. Sorry. Some people can't hear without it.
I'm curious, Paul, what is it that you're wearing?
It is, the Japanese name for it is, excuse me, it's a symbol that I'm training to be the supreme super humble.
How's he doing, Zen students?
When you're in training, you don't get a ride, you just get a brine. It's a miniature Buddhist robe. And when you get an ordination in the Zen tradition, this is what comes along with it. But you sew it yourself, and so it's a very exacting process.
That's what he says to the outsiders. To the insiders, every morning he says it's a field far beyond form and emptiness.
I was giving you the straightforward answer.
How is it a field far beyond form and emptiness?
Well, in one way there's a historical Buddha who wore a Buddha's robe, and then there's another way in which the sacredness of practice and the blessing of practice clothes everyone who practices, whether they realize it or not, and that creates a Buddha field, and that Buddha field is neither constricted by form or constricted by emptiness.
Wonderful. the other Kim.
With the paramitas, from what I've heard this week, I'm led to understand that the first paramitas, generosity and rightful action and patience will, for example, support right effort, effortless effort. So it kind of leads me to my question, as somebody who struggles to sit in samadhi at all, is that necessary in order to be able to access wisdom?
Yes. But the question is, what do we mean by samadhi? So, if samadhi is, if you go along with how I'm presenting it partly, if samadhi means really being true to yourself, really recognizing the truth of yourself here, that's required for wisdom. Whether it requires to go into deep states of meditative absorption to do that, that depends on a person. Some people find that really useful, and some people never have that experience and don't need to have it in order to find this samadhi of truth.
Thank you.
I'm curious, the Zen model of mindfulness feels a little bit more open than the Anapana as you teach it, Gil. How does that compare? Is there a spectrum with Utejaniya's, the way he teaches open awareness?
I think you should answer this, because I'm not exactly clear about how Utejaniya teaches open awareness.
I've never studied with Utejaniya, so I'm not qualified to answer.
With the notion of open awareness as a different style of mindfulness as opposed to sharp focus on anapana.
Yeah. There's a wide range of ways of using awareness or using attention. And attention is, I think of awareness as being very fluid. It's like water that can take the shape of any container it goes into. And we can use it so many different ways. We can use it very focused and narrow. We can use it very broad and wide. We can use awareness to see things kind of from a real distance and step back. We can use awareness to be really intimate and close. And all the ways of being awareness are useful in certain circumstances. And so to be fluid, to be able to move between different forms of awareness, or different forms of concentration, different ways to use awareness more, is very useful, so we don't get fixated on one way as the right way, but rather it's situational and knowing how to flow. And as a teacher, one of the things I'm interested in is not so much that people enter into any particular state of awareness or attention or concentration. It's useful, different states, but I'm very interested in how fluid people are moving between them and how they can, and that's where freedom can be found. And then for different people, in terms of finding access to real stability, being really present, and that opening up to some wisdom, different personalities, different minds function differently. Some minds are very focused very easily on concentration. They're concentration minds, and that's a doorway that works really well to go deep and into wisdom and freedom. Other minds are more mindfulness minds, and they don't go necessarily easy into concentration, but they can be very mindful and moment by moment. Some minds work really well being focused and have a clear stability of a place. Some people need to they work much better for them to have a very open, broad, unfocused, undirected awareness. And so I think teachers tend to teach what works for them. And so some teachers have found it really worked well to go just direct and narrow. Some people really wide. I found that both through my Zen training and the way I was taught in Burma and Thailand to practice Vipassana, that the focus on breathing was extremely helpful. And I found breathing to be a very, very powerful and helpful practice. And I think that it's one that works very well for a wide range of people, but not for everyone. And then the question is how narrowly focused to be on the breathing and how broad. And that's kind of part of the art. But I find that sooner or later, You know, and it also it's dependent on what's going on in the mind. So sometimes the mind is in one state, it's better to have a stable, clear, single focus. That seems to be the most helpful. And when the state of mind is in a different way, it's better to have very broad and open focus. What I like to try to teach is, when I emphasize breathing as a foundation, is to, in shorthand would be to say, to use the breathing as a primary focus, because that's where a good place to develop both concentration and mindfulness. But to, and so you are narrowing the attention to, you know, a certain subdomain of totality. But as you focus on there, to do it in just that area with the same quality of relaxed openness as you would have for the open awareness attention. But it's open awareness in a smaller domain. And that seems to, for me, gets just the right balance of the benefits of stability and steadiness and clarity of what's going on and a very relaxed and open, spacious mind.
And I would answer it like this. I would say that, to paraphrase Gill a little bit, that in both traditions, if you look at them carefully, if you look at how attention to breath is taught, you know, even just in Burma, there's quite a range, you know? I mean, in Thailand it is true, there's a lot of contact, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on contact at the nostrils, but that's not the totality of it. I mean, I trained in Thailand, and that was offered as one option. And similarly, in the Zen school, if you look at the Rinzai school, there's a very forceful energetic relationship to breath. And then in the Soto school, there's something quite different. I would say in the Zen school, the structure of the sitting posture has more emphasis than in many of the variations of the Vipassana school. But my notion is that the foundations, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness are in both schools. And there are differences. The one notable difference, I would say, is that overall in the Vipassana school, I experience, especially in the West, an inclination towards absorption as an inclusive factor. And in the Zen school, an inclination towards integration. You know, like we will sit meditation, and then we will eat as a mindfulness exercise, and it's really to bring the samadhi of sitting into this process. But that process is quite interactive. It's not you just get your food and you sit there. No, you're constant. There's and that interaction both with other people and with the environment and the particulars has an integrative quality of what's cultivated in the sitting stillness. And so often in the Zen school, there will be other things included in the process of the sesshin or the retreat.
It's interesting to see the difference between the different practice traditions between their rhetoric and what they do in practice. And sometimes you have to look at both, because if you only look at the rhetoric, you get only a one-sided perspective on it. So like when I was practicing in Japan, there seemed to be a lot of emphasis on concentration. That was the rhetoric. But the practice, like Paul said, was all about supporting and helping mindfulness. All the bells and the bowing and the meals. It was like, but they didn't teach you mindfulness. But the whole setup was they didn't teach you mindfulness, because there was the whole setup was to be, you know, supporting it. They just said concentrate. And then you could go, when I went to Burma, there the rhetoric was all about mindfulness. We don't do the concentration thing. We do the mindfulness thing. But the whole setup was set up to get concentrated. But we don't do concentration, but the whole but you know, everything was like, everything was supporting deep concentration as we did the mindfulness practice. So you have to be a little bit careful and be able to kind of don't just listen to the rhetoric, but also look and see what's done. And often the two are mutually supportive, but sometimes part of it is not actually taught, but you have to practice it. Maybe one more.
I just found this discussion really interesting, really helpful. And I was wondering about these many different techniques and these many different tendencies people can have towards open awareness or a more concentrated practice or one technique over another. And I'm curious about recommendations for either maybe practicing with what feels easiest, where we have a tendency or an inclination, versus having a practice and practicing without preferences around what we're doing, rather than moving around to the practice or the object of attention that feels easiest or most pleasant.
Maybe to shift it a little bit and not say to practice what's easiest, but in your practice to discern, as Gil was saying, your own tendencies. And our own tendencies will quite likely be what we're drawn towards. And initially will be where we will feel some kind of fuller engagement. And then often that supports, encourages our practice. And then at some point we need to, and usually this happens organically, you know, that as we're exploring more, we see that, oh, well, I tend to avoid this. Or maybe psychologically, there's a deeper sense of trust in our own being and our own practice, and it becomes more adventurous. And then we start to pick up aspects of practice that previously, as we were drawn by our inclinations, we weren't attending to so much. Like I was initially drawn towards concentration. And so very conveniently in my own mind, I had a story that concentration was the essence of Buddhist practice. And so I was just doing what was the essence of Buddhist practice. And then after quite a while, it occurred to me, maybe there were other things too.
Yeah, sometimes it's useful to more or less stay with one practice, especially if you're relatively new, stay with one thing and not jump around, because jumping around doesn't allow you to go very far with anything and really see yourself. So stay with something for a while. And doesn't really matter what you do at first, but I think to spend a year at least with something, some kind of practice, because a year of practice will give you a different dharma, a different ability to discern. And after that year, you can come up and look around and see if there's some practice that's a better fit, or you need to understand yourself better. And so. But I think having some commitment to something for a while is a good beginning. And then be careful for jumping around and looking at your tendency. And some people change and switch too quickly and they never get settled. Great. Thank you all. That was nice. And so we're going to shift soon and start making kind of, Kim's going to make some announcements in a few minutes about some of the closing here, or things you need to know, and about how it ends here. And there'll be more announcements tomorrow, but just what you need to know this evening. And but I'd like to use this occasion to just make sure that, I don't know how to say this exactly, but make sure that you all have been as nourished and supported as you could be by the whole system that we have here. There's a lot of people and a lot of care has gone into creating I think a pretty amazing Dharma center where the very structure and form and approach and the way it's been organized and offered is with the wish that it becomes a field of compassion, care, generosity that supports, it creates kind of very ideal conditions to let your Dharma practice grow, let your practice grow, or let you grow. And that somehow the way it's organized here is not casual, not like incidental, just show up and, you know, stroll in, and we don't charge anything, so just come, you know, it's like, you know, it's not really worth that much, you know, and you know, it doesn't really matter, you know, anything. So I just wander in and, you know, have some food and, you know, wander off and, you know, that was nice, nice people, nice place. And, you know, but in fact, you know, there's a lot of attention is given to this. So I think it's quite remarkable that we have a practice center that's fueled by generosity, goodwill, and gratitude. And that's kind of, we hope, is the nourishment for all of us. And that you've come here and participated in that, and that you've offered your gratitude and goodwill, and maybe you've had some gratitude in the work you've done, this practice you've done, and your support and kindness for your community here. I know deep in my heart, I know that each of you came here with your own background and causes and conditions and situation of your life, and that this place here is hope. We want to welcome you fully and make this a place where you can really meet and deal with some of the most important issues of your life that is met with through the Dharma. And I know that it's powerful what goes on here, and some of you it's very challenging to be here, what you have to meet with and be with, but we do it together, and we're all supporting each other. We don't just do it as individuals, but we also do it as a collective. And what any individual is going through is part of what we're all going through. We're all working together for the greater good for all of us. And it's part of the lesson, I think, of what I'd like to hope we impart here is, in a culture which tends to be hyper-individualistic, that we also learn that we are individuals, but we're also members of a community and a society and participants in it, and that we want to really kind of also be able to have a heart that's big enough to hold all of it and see and appreciate that we're all in process as a group together. And if one person's having a hard time, we're all there for that. We're all growing together with that and healing together with that. I remember when there was a retreat like a few years ago here, and there was a woman that Paul knows her, who would start sobbing and shaking very loudly. Like when you first hear it, you think that she's having a heart attack or something very violent is going on. And it was quite, and people were kind of alarmed. And by the end of the retreat, everyone held her with tremendous compassion and care. Everyone understood that she was doing her really great work, and there's very few places in the world she could go and be held and do this practice. It was so important for her. And I think everyone grew, everyone healed in being holding her that way. And so we have our friends across the street. They're part of our community too. And we don't know what they're doing there, but it's not us versus them. It's us here as well. And so we have this place where it's, you know, we hope that these values or these ways of being and hold each other all the volunteers, that there's a tremendous amount of volunteers in the background who make it possible for us to be here that are invisible to us. So I hope that you kind of have grokked or understood this as in a supportive way, an inspiring way, And that maybe, just maybe, what happens here is contagious. And it can grow, and other people will get the little bug that how wonderful it is to offer the Dharma, practice the Dharma in this kind of environment of generosity and goodwill. And we can see more of it in this world. Thank you. Do you want to use this? Is it easier? Or?
Yeah.